Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and this week we'll be talking about surveillance capitalism, what it means for your privacy, and the future of finance and technology. Please hit subscribe to keep up with this and the latest in FinTech news. All right, with me this week is Steve.
Hey, John. Good to be here.
Glad you're here, or else I'd be all by myself, actually.
You would be. That would be a very lonely episode.
It would be. It would not nearly be as interesting.
It would not be as fun. Just you droning on for 45 minutes.
Well, I'm glad you're here, too, because actually I wanted to ask you, what is surveillance capitalism?
What is surveillance capitalism? That's a great question. I think it has to do with the fact that a lot of the new players in the tech space now are basing their models on how much they surveil you and how much they use that data to, quote unquote, give you services, which they can then use for advertisers. That's basically the gist of it, is how do we get you to buy more stuff, given what we know about you?
Okay, so they can manipulate you? It's like the negative side of nudges and positive?
Dark patterns and all that kind of stuff, yeah.
Dark patterns. Wait, what's a dark pattern?
So a dark pattern is basically, it's something that was identified by somebody who actually used to be at Google. And the whole concept is that you create these things so that you create engagement, but actually end up having users make negative decisions. Or rather, you're trying to optimize for engagement, and then you actually end up creating outcomes that are not beneficial to the user. So for example, the famous one is that if you've noticed, a lot of your notifications on your phone are red, like the Facebook one, if you have Facebook. By the way, don't have Facebook. But that's based on science and the fact that red is a very, red really calls to you as a color. And if you make something red, it means you're going to click on it. So it's like, you know, remember back in the day when Facebook used to email you so-and-so tagging a photo? Right? So that's basically a way for them to create patterns to get you to become interested in the platform and just increase engagement, quote unquote.
Which is basically so it could be like your behavior as well as forcing engagement or addiction with a product.
It's exactly that. It's either they can manipulate your behavior with technological ways, either the way that something is designed or the way that something is surfaced, so that you can again engage more with the platform.
Okay, so, you know, we're just looking at an article about the surveillance capitalism. There's a author, Shoshana Zuboff, who came out with this book recently, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, that had some really interesting implications for, especially as finance is moving more and more mobile, that these things are starting to apply. And, you know, we mentioned before how banks are slowly starting, or financial services slowly starting to erode towards away from this protected, neutral protector of your data, your financial information, to becoming just like Google and Facebook and everybody else that makes money off of your online identity or behaviors.
Right. Yeah. So there's a really interesting thing in this article, which is in a piece of it, they mentioned that your bank used to be sort of like your priest, right? Like you would just tell it secrets. Only your bank would know your transaction history. But now they're getting into the business of actually selling that data and monetizing your data to again sell you more stuff. Which is, it sounds like it's a minimal thing, but it's actually a really ground-shaking turnaround for banks and other FIs.
One of the things she mentions also is that there isn't really a government response. So, and it's not visible, so people don't really respond to it, right? We're much more attuned to dangers we can see. You know, people are afraid of shark attacks and not, you know, traffic accidents. And I think we've mentioned that kind of effect before. But as humans, we're kind of flawed in making risk assessments.
We certainly are. I think that's especially the case now because we're also tied to our phone. So any sort of risk that's contained within your phone, you tend to either kind of disregard or sort of deprioritize as your risk assessment, you know, framework. But yeah, it's actually something that's becoming quite pernicious and quite ubiquitous also within financial services.
So let's start with some of the benefits, if we know what it is. So what are the ways that it's being justified, the use of more and more monitoring of your behavior and your meta behavior, right? Because it's not like it's not just just a quick aside. It's not just your location or exactly what you bought, but it's also they can measure things like how fast you respond to questions on a online credit application.
They can
Be factored in. All these things you know your. Your gait, how quickly you...
If you're walking or not, they're actually... I've been in
meetings... When you're doing things, yeah.
Yeah, I've been in meetings with a company that promises that they can actually surface a notification on your phone based on whether you're walking or not. So even that level of activity. Whether you're charging your phone, whether you're at a near merchant. So there's all these ways in which they can essentially assess John and who you are and what you do to create a service that they think would be good for you and for them.
So imagine you just sneeze, you're in the street, and then your phone comes up with a coupon for Kleenex.
Exactly. That's sort of the next level, but we're not that far off from that.
So yeah, it's not just that name, birth date, information that you're used to giving away or gets hacked into.
No, it's transaction data.
It's far more than that.
It's location data. It's also your device data. I was also part of a study maybe about 2 years
ago. Are you an Android or iOS user?
Well, yeah.
That's pretty basic,
but actually for my day job, I was in a study where we were looking at alternative on credit underwriting models. And one thing that we came up with or that we found from the data is that if you are the kind of person that leaves your phone under 20% battery on a regular basis, you are a credit risk. Isn't that incredible? Because I think there's a correlation between the irresponsibility of not charging your freaking phone, just charge it, and not being able to pay back your debts.
Yeah, I saw that. That was that's pretty interesting.
Pretty amazing
but
stuff.
But that they would know that they, who's they? Who's
so they meaning any company, any app that has system level access to your phone can also see your battery level, whether you're walking or not, where you are, all the apps you have on the phone. They can essentially see everything in there. And yeah, we just saw that as that's pretty interesting that there's a correlation between low battery and not paying back your debts.
So that's one of the key points of surveillance capitalism, actually, is that people are gathering your information without your consent.
If you opt in.
More than you would think that you're giving away, actually, right? Because no one's going to read the whole thing. Or even in this case, know the implications of system-level data.
Yeah.
Means that they're going to be watching and making judgments on you based on things you had no idea had any correlation. Or even if they're wrong and to be misjudged, right?
It's true, yeah. And it's something that I've become more...
I mean, if you're 80%, they're 80% sure, you could be that 20% that they misjudge you about.
It's true. And it really also extends beyond the phone. So even for me, I've switched recently from Chrome to Firefox. I feel a little bit of reluctance whenever I Google something on Chrome because I know that that's going to be used to inform my profile. And also because I have an Android phone and I use Google Now, the Google Now launcher, I get a lot of articles. And if I Google, say, like black hole in astrophysics, I can expect to be inundated with articles from science.com or something about black holes, which is cool, but it's sort of like I don't want to be reading about black holes forever. It's just a one-time right, search, right? So stop surveilling what I do online to inform my profile about you know, my personal profile.
So some keys from this book is that there's this appropriation of user behavior without trying to kind of treating it as this free resource. And the analogy she gives is kind of like when the settlers came to the U.S. and so all these, you know, everything was untouched and just kind of claimed it all because there's no one to say no. And we haven't been good about thinking about data and our behavior and our privacy in that way.
We have not, no.
But like Google's getting free natural resources or free input into their profit-making machine. And you don't see that, even though we're all contributing to it, right?
Right.
And the other thing she mentioned is exactly that point, that there's no laws surrounding this. When Google first started, nobody had really thought of that. They didn't really succeed until they stopped not being evil
right.
and started being very profitable,
right.
Which I guess a lot of people can say, well, you know, that's just business. That's just making money from what's out there. That's innovation. You know, why would you try to stop that?
It's true, yeah. But what we're seeing is that there's many more ways to capture your data now. They're sort of beyond what you saw, rather, with Google 15, 20 years ago, right? Now it's getting into your you know, your IoT devices, your mobile phone, your device information, your browser history. There's a lot of digital exhaust out there that you leave.
I love that phrase, the digital exhaust.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
That's all that gate or the walking and all the other information you don't know that you're giving off.
It's the traces of information that can be used to create, again, a more holistic profile about you and what stuff we can sell you as well.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because this is this article that we'll link to in the show notes here highlights how a lot of banks are looking to analyze your transaction data to sell you what's called in the industry merchant funded rewards. And that's basically, you went to Chipotle last week. We said that because you're your bank, and now we'll give you 10% off at Chipotle the next time you go. Which sounds like a good customer experience. I think it ultimately is, but it's based on the fact that, again, they're using data that used to be kept kind of to have that, priest kind of relationship where it's
some
just
protection
between you and the bank. Exactly. And now they're using that to get you to buy more stuff.
It's almost like if you don't think of it as something, that you shouldn't be concerned about, think of it as, all your stuff in your safe deposit box, and they're selling all the behavior of the people based on what's inside your safe deposit box.
That's a pretty good analogy, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, you think you have privacy, but you don't, and they're making money from that, your private information.
They're making money. So the way that the concept works is there's a company called Cardlytics in New York. I think they're in New York. I'm assuming they are. Anyway, we'll assume they are. Yeah, they're in New York or NSF somewhere, or in the Bay Area. But they essentially work with most of the large banks. So I know they work with Chase and Wells Fargo and potentially Citibank as well. And what they do is that, again, they can analyze a user's transaction history. They can then onboard merchants on their side, so say Chipotle, Little Caesars, Amazon, what have you. And they can say, we know that John has been to Chipotle or another fast food restaurant in the past few, whatever, 6 months or so, or 3 months. We can then surface John an offer to go to Chipotle. He gets a discount. The bank gets to have more card usage and have that card be top of wallet, aka you're going to use that card over your other cards. The merchant gets more foot traffic in the store, and the customer gets essentially a discount, which sounds like a pretty good deal. I think that all parties win. But the issue that I have with this one is that it's sort of enabling behavior that could not be good for you. It's really incentivizing, but it could
be a different kind of dark pattern.
Exactly. Yeah. It's basically, keep on eating fast food. Like it's never going to say, since you've been to Chipotle three times in the past 2 weeks, maybe go to the salad place. Right. It will never say that. It'll say, here's more Chipotle.
Or you'll have to pay extra for that.
Exactly.
Kind of like if you don't give your card at the store, you don't get the discount.
Right. And that's, again, based on your data, because they want to see what kind of stuff
you're
buying.
Because they want your data. Yeah,
that's
absolutely worth it.
Yeah.
Yeah, for them.
It's a goldmine of information.
But I get 5% off milk.
Yeah.
I got to keep that.
I get, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I like the way at the beginning of this article, Shoshana Zuboff mentions that Sheryl Sandberg was kind of like the Typhoid Mary.
Such a great term. Absolutely.
Of spreading this kind of data exhaust and using data, the individuals as the natural resource and the advertisers as the customer.
Right. And for those of you who don't know,
so it spread from Google,
right,
figuring this out and how to make money, and Facebook was, infamously losing money for a long time. And the way they make money is from exactly that same kind of model.
It is.
And Sheryl Sandberg was kind of that link for that.
They are.
That.
And they also have what's widely acknowledged to be one of the best targeting platforms in Instagram. Apparently, the ads on Instagram are eerily accurate and impression based on what you want to buy. So that's all based, again, all the data that they consume.
Yeah, it's maybe not so eerie if you see what they know about you.
Yeah, I mean, where you are.
At any given
friends,
time. Not static, but on an ongoing basis.
Right, right.
So why would this be a good thing from the consumer's point of view? What would they see?
So from the consumer side, if you're going to buy dinner anyway, you may as well get a discount for it. If you already have a card that gives you rewards, maybe you pay for, you may as well get some, three times, 3x the points or something. Or there's sort of financial incentives that make sense.
I saw with the Apple card, if you buy that new Mac Pro, which you can,
I saw that,
which
as well,
you can,
yeah,
scale up to almost $53,000. I think it's 53 with the wheels.
Is that right? the cheese grater one?
The cheese grater Mac Pro.
Yeah.
The Apple Card will give you 6% on that purchase.
As opposed to three on
so
the
you could get $3,000, you know, in points or I think is a you get the cash
back, right? I think, yeah. So that's a pretty good customer experience, but it's based on incentivizing you to buy this very expensive $50,000+ yeah. machine, which you probably don't need.
Yeah. But so there's discounts. Are there any positives? Any other positives in terms of? It's not always leading you to a bad outcome or a bad food experience.
It depends. I think that it's incentivizing more spending, which is not always the best outcome for a lot of users. It's just getting you to spend more money. So I think that we'll want to save money. That makes sense. We'll want that more, you know, more cashback points. But I think that this is just kind of getting you to do more. And that's it, the way that I think about it, sort of the way in which YouTube famously will, if you watch one video about one topic, it'll give you more extreme videos on the same topic. Hmm. And you kind of go down a rabbit hole, but you become more radicalized in a way. This is a way for you to radicalize your spending. If you like fast food, we're going to give you a lot of fast food options here. So you're going to go to Chipotle and you're going to love it because you're getting all this cash back.
So they mentioned GDPR as like a good start towards, you know, people protecting data and owning data, and that this surveillance capitalism model is not inevitable. It's just that we haven't, like we said, it's not the kind of thing that we're prepared to understand.
Yeah.
It's amorphous. It's
it's really complicated.
It's hard to see the costs. And so when people say, hey, you're just trying to stop innovation or just, you know, make, you know, let's just do business and stop, you know, interfering. But you know, there really are costs, and we choose the society that we
do. But I think this is the good example of basically industry and quote unquote innovation getting ahead of the regulation essentially here. And we're seeing a lot of pushback now. You mentioned GDPR, but you can also see it in California with the California privacy law going into effect. I think next year, right? Early next year is when that's going into effect.
Yeah.
I think early Q1 of 2020 is when it'll be in effect. But there's a lot of pushback now. I know that New York is looking at a similar law as well. So we're seeing kind of a burgeoning movement to really check the companies that are trying to use your data in ways that could be pernicious or not, or just use your data, period. But just ways in which your data can be used to manipulate you into doing something that maybe may not be in your best interest.
Yeah. And she mentions also that this kind of new technology, this kind of new innovation, is different than past disruptions that kind of challenged people. Also, with this kind of technology, the way it scales in terms of like technology and server farms are what grow, not the employment. So there's an interesting statistic she brings up. General Motors employed more people at the worst part of the Depression than Google or Facebook employ right now at their peak.
That's, to be fair, that seems like it's sort of an unfair comparison because those workers are a lot more productive. And I think that if you look at it in terms of, you know, from a purely shareholder value perspective, I'm sure that every employee at Google and Facebook is producing more company value, more enterprise value than a worker.
Yeah, the nature of technology is
it's just changed. Yeah.
Scaled differently.
Yeah.
But it's not spreading around the wealth as much as before.
I'm keen to see what the future holds in the next 20 years with this stuff, because I think that, again, there's a lot of societal, individual, and regulatory pushback on this stuff. So, you know, this is sort of where we are now in late 2019, late stage capitalism, whatever. But I think that in 5 or 10 years, we may see a different sort of take on this stuff as well. That's my thinking on it, is that things will improve so that maybe we'll take back some of the control from these corporations and make it about the users instead.
Yeah,
but I could
be
an idealist.
You know, I think we're a long way from getting people to understand that they should have control of their data, or maybe that maybe they don't want it tracked at all. That nobody should own the data. The data shouldn't be collected in the first place. So that's may or may not even be an option, right?
And so a lot of the models that I've come across actually promise to only use the data for maybe 30 minutes to target the users.
But what if I don't want the data saved at all? I don't want you to track how long it takes me to click on this or...
Yeah. So to be an advocate, at least from a financial service perspective, you can opt out. Unlike the Google and Facebooks of the world, banks usually have an opt-in model where if you don't opt in, you don't get that service and your data is not tracked. The other companies, however,
you know, that's my concern. Is the data really not tracked, or is it gathered and just not used for one purpose or another?
It's probably not tracked. I think banks are under a lot of
don't they still use it for fraud detection and other uses though?
They do, but I think that's different than the whole merchant funded reward things. I think that
But if I don't want my data collected at all,
then you may have a crappier experience. Then you may experience more fraud. Then you maybe your card could be declined if you're on vacation. So there are a lot of negative outcomes as well based on you're not giving your bank the data that they need to actually conduct their business.
It just should be better protected, walled.
Walled, not protected. Hacked. Yes. Well, yeah, actually, this is actually a great point. We talk a lot about how all these Bitcoin exchanges are hacked consistently. That hasn't been the case with banks, really. There's been a few breaches here and then. There's
Capital One.
Cap One was a big one, of course, but that was somebody who got access to their AWS server. That's fine. It happened with Chase when I was there like 10 years ago. But it hasn't really happened as much as you would think it would happen. So I think
considering that's where all the money is.
Right. So okay. I think, yeah.
But relatively?
I think so. And I think that banks actually do have pretty secure. That's
the reason. I'm sure they get wrapped on the hands pretty ferociously. You know, the regulators are really going to come down on them.
I'm sure they do, but it's a reason why for a lot of consumer apps, they tout that they have bank-level security, because banks do have pretty incredible security for the most part, I think.
Yeah.
Right? Because you see, I had maybe Headspace or something, some app that I use, and they were saying how we have bank-level security, and it's like, I don't know, this is just like a shitty like meditation app. I don't need to have a bank-level security on this, but somehow they do.
Lincoln Savings level security. Yeah. An 80s reference, sorry.
Yeah.
So I think part of the issue is that so many unregulated, so even if the banks, you know, the real full-tier, full-service banks are highly regulated and are constantly being watched for their security levels and data protection, and they have severe reputation risk also, so they have incentives to protect that. But with all this financial service disruption that's going on, you know, Google, Facebook, you know, any startup that wants to can kind of, if they have the money, they can plug into an API and provide financial services, and then just marketing. So, and they don't have all this regulation. So
they don't. And I think actually that's where the big issue is. We've talked about how it seems like everyone now has a debit card, right? And they usually partner with a smaller bank because smaller banks can charge a higher transaction fee on the debit rails, sort of based on the Durbin Amendment. That'll make sense. But one issue here is that a lot of these partnerships may enable these players, these non-financial players, to also use data in a way that a larger bank or even a bank at all may be unable or unwilling to use.
Yeah. So their marketing is not being monitored. The bank that's regulated, the one that has the bank charter that they're using, is taking care of the back end, but how those customers come in isn't necessarily scrutinized the same way, right?
Correct, yeah. It's a reason why when Google launched its Google Cash product, or announced it rather, they partnered with both Citibank, but also Stanford Credit Union, which is a small bank that basically would only handle the KYC, AML, and all that stuff.
So you have all these technology companies, you have fintechs, you have
telecom now with T-Mobile having a checking account. They all do the same exact thing.
Yeah, so just about anybody can start offering financial services. And so even though it's like having a dam with just the middle of it built and all the water is rushing around it, and your data is escaping.
Your data, yeah. You know, your exhaust is going all over the place.
All over the place. And the bank's saying it's they're protecting it, but it's all going out, you know, through your phone, through other providers anyway.
Correct.
All right, just don't leave your house. Disconnect. Get off the grid.
Get off the grid, yeah.
And you'll be fine.
Yeah. I was just reading an article today about how to have a phone but not be tied to your phone. And I think I'm
hold on, I'm getting a call.
Yeah. I think that my resolution for next year will be to basically spend less time with my phone. I mean, I already like sleep in a separate room within my phone. I keep it in my office, not my bed, not my bedroom. I turn off any kind of sounds, but essentially find ways to interact less with that device. It really controls your life.
Wow. Look at you. And you're one of the few. All right, that's it for this episode of the FinTech Newscast. Please feel free to email us at info@fintechnewscast.com if you have any questions or comments. And please hit subscribe so we can keep track and watch you. And what other podcasts you're cheating on us with. And thanks for listening.
Bye for now.